Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, really great show. I mean, I think this is just the core of Homegrown, talking about trees, talking about the natural world. We've got two fabulous guests. Michael Gage is a naturalist that 21 Century Parks brought in to help with the park initiative along Floyd's Fork. You know, it's an intergovernmental, private, you know, how much people are involved. But just, you know, what's the story along Floyd's Fork?
Yeah, he's a great guy. I met him. I was lucky enough to write an article with Louisville Magazine about Michael. Spent a day with him in the woods. And it's kind of, there's so many aha moments, and why didn't I think of that moment? Mm-hmm. He takes you out in the woods and points out things that you ought to know, but you don't.
Right.
And he's spending weeks out there walking every one of the almost 4,000 acres of the fork, documenting what's there.
What a job,
there,
huh?
Yeah, and what will be best use for the park and how to use it. Just a fascinating young man, and we're just glad to have him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So stick around. I think you'll really, really enjoy that, particularly if you're looking forward to all the opportunities that the park is going to...
Many.
I mean, they're already offering opportunities, but that will ultimately offer. And then the American chestnut. Everybody loves the American chestnut, but unfortunately a sad chapter in American history as well because of the chestnut blight. But efforts are being made, in fact, to breed and crossbreed and backbreed and all of that so that we can reintroduce the chestnut into our landscapes. And a book was written on it by Susan Frankel that's a fabulous glimpse into that long story. So we'll be speaking with her in the second part of the show.
Yep, be good.
Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, this was Hidden Hill closed a couple weeks ago. It was a Sunday afternoon, just a beautiful sunny day. I sat down on a bale of potting soil and looked around and looked at the green grass and the blue sky and the yellow sunlight.
And said it doesn't get any better
than this. A sense of peace came over me like I haven't felt in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want people to do that more often. Just sit down and enjoy what's out there. It was just marvelous, and a sense of pride, too. We've done a lot out there to create trees and pasture and green, and you are, too. It's your place. But you have to enjoy that at some point in time. And I just enjoyed that so much, and I wanted to hang on to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have.
Yeah. I think I can, I try to do that almost every evening, quite frankly, when I go back and like feed cheap whole wheat bread to the chickens. And I mean, it is, it's like this moment, it lends to the whole notion of observation too. And I think Michael will speak to this when we talk about the Floyd's Fork thing. What we observe, how do we take the opportunity to sit and open our eyes and look and contemplate and take it all in? And I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, no matter where you are, whether it's a little backyard or a balcony, I mean, even our crow woman had talked about it, living in that urban environment, the urban wilderness, sit peacefully and observe and...
And do it.
Exactly. Yep. Speaking of the chickens, that's what I did this morning.
Okay. Because
we've had a couple of frosts and, you know, things have pooped out in the vegetable garden. So I went to the vegetable garden and I picked up, you know, ripe but rotten tomatoes and frost damaged peppers these different things in a bucket, and then threw them into the chicken yard for them.
Not at the chickens.
No. Just so they had something to to munch on that was more interesting than chicken feed and scratch and stuff like that. So yeah, the power ups of observation and how comforting it can be.
It's necessary, really.
It is necessary, absolutely.
Really is.
All right, speaking of which, I am very excited to take advantage of Floyd's Fork more than ever because of Michael Gage and what he has taught us in terms of how to read the area.
Yeah, Michael, our guest today, has a job that combines his passion for the natural world and all its past history with the park's development that will guarantee Louisville residents access to that natural world for many years to come. He's with us today to talk about the almost 4,000-acre park project along Floyd's Fork being created by 21st Century Parks and his part in it. Michael, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Great.
Let's talk about the project first. What's going on along Floyd's Fork from Shelbyville Road to Bardstown Road?
So Floyd's Fork of the Salt River, which is the full name of that water body, between Shelbyville Road and Bardstown Road, 21st Century Parks, Future Fund, and Louisville Metro Parks have acquired pretty close to 4,000 acres that kind of spread out along the fork. So it's 19 miles of stream, And along both sides, there are all these new acquired properties that are going to be open to the public. So they're putting together a plan for what this parkland is going to look like. And so that's going on now. And in the future, what it's going to be is essentially 4,000 acres of public park.
Mm-hmm. And your happy job, and we'll get back to this a little bit later, is to walk every acre of that 4,000 acres and sort of interpret what was there before, is also develop best uses for the parkland without getting in the way of people who want to go look at it and destroying the land itself. But talk about your background and training. What got you into this kind of work, and where did you go to put a fine point on it?
Yeah, I grew up a suburban kid who found the vestigial patches of woods around where I grew up, north of Albany, New York. And as I got older, my geography got bigger, and I ended up studying ecology, got a couple degrees in that, and here I am. Mm-hmm. So it's really just spending a lot of time outdoors.
But you've been other places, essentially. You're not like hometown is Louisville. It's not like you were, you know, intimately familiar with or involved with Floyd's Fork in this area. So what actually brought you into, you know, this project?
Yeah, I had never stepped off the pavement in Kentucky until I got here. My travels usually brought me from the Northeast to the West, mm-hmm. when I always just drove quickly through Kentucky. But in my graduate studies, my advisor is a guy named Tom Wessels. Mm-hmm. And Tom is a fairly well-known New England ecologist. And he wrote a popular book called Reading the Forest and Landscape. And so as I worked with him, Dan Jones, who heads 21st Century Parks, he thinks very highly of Tom's method of natural history and reading the landscape. And so Dan contacted Tom, and Tom came down here to Louisville and spent a few days. And after that trip, Dan sort of conceived of this project to get someone out there to find these landscape stories all along this 4,000 acres. And he asked Tom, you know, find someone to do this, and mm-hmm. I ended up in Louisville.
Yeah. So Michael, then, like, okay, the question, why is it so important, you know, if he conceives of this, you know, finding out the stories of these landscapes along Floyd's Fork, why is that even important, and what is that going to tell us, and how is that going to maximize the experiences that people could potentially have, you know, once they actually use these areas?
Yeah, Dan figured out a process that is incredibly simple, but it's just remarkable. It's a remarkable way to look at getting people outside. So, for example, you can tell someone, this is an oak tree, and without showing them the spot. So you can look at oak trees in books, mm-hmm. But to really understand the oak tree, you should go out and look at it. So Dan decided that we should figure out where are the special places that tell the stories for Floyd's Fork. And that was the goal of this project, was where are the places on the ground that you can bring someone and show them the landscape stories? Don't tell them, you know, in a classroom.
This exists here. Yeah. Put it into actual textual context.
Put it into a story, and better yet, put it into a place on the ground, uh-huh. where you can see the pieces of the story. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did, was walk around and find these stories. And I have some 275 places that you can go check these things out, but I tried to boil them down to, I think there's about 20, that if you take all these 20 sites and you can understand them, you'll really get a good sense of this whole picture. Mm-hmm. So that's everything from the geologic story of the Midwest to the abandonment of the farms out in Floyd's Fork.
Well, let's talk about that, Michael. I was lucky enough to spend a day with you a while back. And how you interpret what's out there now by looking at the evidence of the past. Everybody calls it CSI Floyd's Fork because that's a cliche everybody knows. But that's what you do. You look at the ruins and stumps and so forth and figure out when and what happened. Talk about that.
Yeah, the process of reading a landscape is again, something we sort of overlook, but it's very, very simple. And it's just a matter of observing a place and putting it into a temporal scale, so in terms of time, and then spatially. And so when I go out in the woods, first thing I always do is I observe what's there. In my head, I sort of have a template for what I'm looking for. So I look at the sizes of trees, the spacing of trees, what species they are, the way the sizes relate to each other, and the way the spacing relates to each other in terms of the trees. Look for other plants. Almost every plant out there is an indicator of something. For example, Dutchman's breeches, the nice little wildflower, it's an indicator of a forest that's never been plowed, because those little corms, the little roots on those, they don't do well after a field's been plowed. And the seeds are dispersed by ants, and it takes a very long time before that plant comes back. So there are a whole host of plants that are good indicators for a place that's never been plowed. Likewise, there are good indicators for a place that has been plowed, like red cedar. Red cedar is a great indicator. You know, it needs full sunlight. So you don't get red cedar coming up generally in the middle of a forest. You need an open ground. So I look for all these different indicators. You know, how are the red cedars arranged? Are there big ones, or are they all 4 inches in diameter? So I look for these types of things and try and puzzle together, you know, all the while going back in time, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, what was going on here, and eventually get to a point where you can't go back any farther. You know, yeah. Who knows what was here 500 yeah. years ago?
It's total speculation after that, right?
Yeah.
But talk about the difference between suckers coming up across an old stump and how you can determine the age of that tree when it was cut down and how long, who did it even sometimes?
Yeah, so there are a number, when you're out in the woods, one of the very common things to see is a tree that has two stems, two trunks coming out of one stump. And trees don't, generally, they don't naturally do that. They have apical dominance. They have a leader that shoots up to the sky. If they're conifers, there's always that one leader. And then if they're hardwoods, you know, eventually they branch out and make a canopy. But we have a lot of trees that have two trunks. And so that's an indicator of a tree that's been cut or killed.
Huh.
So not all trees do this. Red cedar, for example, and most conifers don't sprout. We call it stump sprouting mm-hmm. or coppicing. And they don't generally do that. Trees that do it and do it well are like oaks, ashes, hickories, maples, all are sort of big hardwood trees.
So if you see the two, it suggests that they've been felled in some sort of way?
It's been cut or killed. So, for example, if a fire comes through in a forest, that can kill a tree.
Uh-huh.
Basically, the fire, it doesn't just go up into the crown of the tree and burn the thing down, but the heat along the base will boil the phloem in the base of the tree and basically girdle it. But that tree can re-sprout right out of the stump. So fire can kill it, and you know, if someone comes and cuts the tree down, it doesn't kill the tree because the root system's still alive and it re-sprouts. And so when you see a tree that has two or sometimes three or even four sprouts, if you look, you know, if you take about halfway between both of those sprouts and go down to the base of the tree, that's going to be about the size of the original tree. And so you can look at that and say, okay, so this original tree was 15 inches in diameter. So it was probably 60, 70 years old, something like this. There's a great site in Miles Park where all this comes together. There's a whole host of trees, oaks and ashes and hickories, and they were all cut around 1913. And
historically, do we know what was going on there in 1913?
Not
can
yet.
You even, so, but that's sort of the fascinating, because this is fabulous, Michael, because that's the fascinating part of it. You can keep on adding components to these things, whether they're natural history or human history, and really tell a story of these places.
Yeah, and that's what's really great about this site in Miles Park is we can look at the original trees, and the original trees were actually quite big.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, 20 inches in diameter. So we know that those trees were probably 100 years old. Which brings us back to the early 1800s, which tells us, you know, in the early 1800s, no one in this area was growing forest. They were clearing them.
Right.
And so that we had trees there in the early 1800s tells us that that site in Miles Park has always been forested.
Mm-hmm.
It's not old growth because the trees have been cut, but it was never plowed or tilled. It's always had a forest on that site.
So what are some of the other, I guess, more surprising things that you've discovered?
I did find some groves of trees that are old growth. Other trees in these stands have been cut, so the whole forest is an old growth, but there are some beech trees out there that are well over 200 years old, 250 or more. Just some of the, there is a particular rock layer called the Rowland layer. It's a calcareous shale. It's kind of like a cross between a limestone and a shale, and it has this great propensity for forming waterfalls. It's soft, and the layer above it is hard, and so once a little stream cuts through that hard layer, once it hits the soft layer, it erodes it out very quickly. So down in the southern part, down around Bardstown Road and in that area, there are at least 20 waterfalls ranging in height from 4 feet to maybe 15 feet or more. They're all waterfalls of this one geologic layer.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the old fences we found walking around in there. And I know you talk about solving that mystery, what you think they are and how they got there. And there's stone around a spring, too, that we saw, I think.
Yeah, that stones around the spring is still... I'm not sure what was going on with that, but it's an active spring. And there are other springs in the southern area down by Bardstown that originate out of one specific geologic layer. But that one that we saw in the north was not related to those. So I'm not sure what's going on with that yet. But oftentimes in the woods, you find barbed wire fence or mesh wire fence, and they're all very old. Barbed wire fence was invented in the late 1800s, 1870s. And before that, they were using either mesh fence or stone walls. Mm-hmm. And there are stone walls around there, but they're usually along the fork. And the reason I come from the Northeast, New York, New England, and where it's kind of, they're kind of known for their stone walls. There, those stone walls are originated out of glacial material. All that place was covered by ice. So you have all these boulders, cobbles, all over the place. And it was the bane of the early farmers. You know, the first few years they had these great agricultural sites, and then the rocks started to come up from the frost, and they must have thought they did something
huge
horrible
pieces of limestone.
And that God was punishing them vehemently. But here that's not the case, because the glacial ice never came down this far. So all we have around here are broken up chunks of the limestone that exists below the soil around here. And so the most place you find that limestone is around the creeks. So this area, we don't have a lot of stone walls, but the ones we do have are really beautiful, because the stone is all the same. You know, in New England you have flat stones and round stones, and they're all different, which has its own beauty. But here you have all the same thickness of these flat slabs of stone. And we're still trying to piece out why these walls are there. Because if you can imagine, if you're a farmer and you're just trying to keep some cows or pigs in or something like this, the amount of time that it would take to build a stone wall is enormous. Mm-hmm. And it may not be sort of a cost benefit. It may not be beneficial to put that much effort into building a stone wall. But there are other places where the stone wall looks like it was put there for some kind of flood control, erosion control, which makes a little more sense.
Mm-hmm. There was one... phrase that came up when I talked to you last time about down trees, the pillow and cradle effect.
Yeah. So Tom Wessels, again, this guy from New England, wrote this book. He calls this pillow and cradles. They're also just called tip-up mounds. And what happens in an old forest, you have big trees, and trees don't last forever. They eventually fall down, either from wind or they just get old, they die, and then they fall over. When they fall over, the root system usually ends up coming up with the tree. And when that happens, it takes a whole mess of soil out with it. And so that forms the hole or the cradle. And then the root has all that soil in it. And over time, the soil falls to the ground as the root system decomposes. And so it makes a mound of dirt. So you have a depression, which is the cradle, and then the mound, which is the pillow, or called a tip-up mound. Right. And so when you see these things in a forest, you see this little depression with a little hill next to it, that's a good sign of that's where a tree fell, basically.
Wow.
In an old-growth forest, you'll find these mounds everywhere. They're all over the place because the forest floor, the soil, has never been altered. But in the sort of humanized landscape, the cultural landscape, those pillows and cradles, those tip-up mounds, have basically been smoothed over either by animals grazing in fields or more likely by plowing. Mm-hmm. And they just, if you are farming a big field, you don't want to have a bunch of hills and depressions because what a pain that would be. Mm-hmm. So they're filled in and smoothed over to make it easy for agriculture.
So what kind of species would be most likely to pop up if you had had a field that was used agriculturally and then it isn't? Because it is sort of amazing how quickly nature can claim these spaces, you know? So if this was an old agricultural field 100 years ago, what trees might we see there now if it was left undisturbed, you know, after agriculture ceased?
Well, for the first thing that will usually come in around here is the red cedar,
Okay. Which
is particular to limestone areas. So if you go out into other places, you know, in the knobs where it's sandstone or these places, you don't get the red cedar quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
So red cedar is the first coming in. Red cedar is a long-lived tree, so that'll persist for quite a while.
So that's a clue.
Yeah. In a lot of areas in Floyd's Fork, the red cedar did come in, and you still find old ones of that, but then the hardwoods came in with the red cedar or just underneath them. And so that's a lot of oaks and hickories and ash.
And do they eventually take over so the cedars are shaded?
Okay. And so those hardwoods can take over, shade the cedars out. The cedars might persist understory for a while, but they won't thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole host of things that can come in underneath that.
Okay.
The one thing we've noticed in Floyd's Fork area and elsewhere is there aren't a lot of things coming in now below those hardwoods. So there's what we call an age discontinuity. So there's no young trees. There are no young trees. And we think a lot of the reason that is because of the overabundance of deer out there.
Okay,
and basically,
well,
the deer are eating all the seedlings and preventing the trees from coming back up underneath.
Let's talk about Floyd's Fork itself, because there are parts along there, as you know, where you look down long valleys. You can't believe you're in Jefferson County or Louisville. It's like a whole different world out there. And this little bitty creek at the bottom of this has created this entire valley, basically, as I understand it.
Yeah, and no one's figured out the sort of geologic story. So in geology, there's the rocks that are made, which is one level, and then there's the landforms, the geomorphology, that's another level. And the way the creek kind of runs through there and erodes pieces out and shapes the valley. And that story, we haven't quite pinned down fully yet. Some people suggest that maybe some of the glacial meltwater was flowing through Floyd's Fork Valley for a while. And the reason that they're thinking this is some call Floyd's Fork an underfit stream, meaning that the stream is quite small relative to its valley. So you have this broad valley down there that in places, you know, it's a third of a mile across or almost a half mile, but the stream, the fork itself, is only like 100 feet. So how did such a small stream make such a big valley? Well, you can either the stream wasn't always small, or it just had such an enormous amount of time that it's just kind of snaked around the valley so much and cut away different pieces for so long. You know, we're talking back to dinosaur age.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the northern part of the United States and Canada, you had the glacial ice. And that's, for me, that's pretty easy to understand. You know, 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, I get that. But down here, you know, we're talking millions of years of
just
the stream just moving and doing its thing.
So your task now is to take all the information you have and fit it into a park template where hundreds of thousands of people will go out there and look at these things, yet protect them at the same time.
Yeah, and that's the challenge.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it's nature is going to change as well.
Right.
And so there's a question of, well, what do we want to keep? What do we want to try and preserve? You know, Bob, we walked through that place I call Redbud Valley,
right,
which has just this abundance of redbuds. And in the spring, it's absolutely a delight because there's just all this pink everywhere. But in 50 years, that won't be there unless someone intentionally manages to keep that there.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you keep that? You know, and we talked about the coyotes that I found in the den, the little pups in there. And if they can last in there in another 50 or 100 years, then that's great. We've been successful.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to figure that out is how to design. You know, there's some great planners that are trying to figure out where to put the trails and the park amenities and everything else to concentrate people so that we can keep some areas as they are for the long term.
And how much do you intervene or not intervene and just let nature take its course, even if that means that something evolves and that means it's gone?
Yeah, that's the question.
We have to be aware of that as well. This is fabulous. It's so fascinating.
Yep. Michael, thank you. And Maybe we'll have you back in a year or so and see how this thing's working out.
That's All right. And we are going to be having a few hikes coming up, sort of get to know introduction to some of these landscapes. So check out 21st Century Parks website, 21cparks.org, and those will be happening soon.
All right.
Glad to do it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Naturalist Michael Gage is helping to create a 20-mile park along Floyd's Fork between Shelbyville and Bardstown Road. For more information on Michael, the park, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, the death and resurrection of the American chestnut. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And more interesting, I know that they're going to try to introduce more American chestnuts back into Floyd's Fork, figuring out where the ideal environments are going to be
exactly,
for them.
Yeah.
But this is the backstory to that as to why there are not any American chestnuts around. Susan Frinkel has put it all in a very, very good book.
Yeah, she's a freelance science journalist who's written for many publications around the country, really. Her book, The American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree, was printed by the University of California Press. She's here today to talk about it. So, Susan, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First, a little bit of personal background. We're kind of curious always where you grew up, what got you interested in the environment, and then particularly what got you into the chestnut tree.
Well, I grew up outside of Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, as I always joke, this was a very weird book for me because, you know, while I like nature and I have sort of, you know, in general an environmental ethic, I'm not really a real tree-oriented person, but I was working on a story for Discover Magazine about sudden oak death, which was a tree disease that surfaced here in Northern California in the late 90s, and it was killing tens of thousands of oak trees here, and everybody was freaking out. And when I talked to scientists, their point of reference was the chestnut blight, which they considered to be, you know, sort of the greatest fiasco and failure of plant pathology because it was this horrible disease and it had never been resolved or cured. And I'd never heard of chestnut blight. I'd never heard of the American chestnut. But I started looking into it and just found that there was this amazing story here about this tree and the people who have been trying, you know, who loved it while it was flourishing and then have been trying to bring it back for a century. So I sort of fell in love with the story.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. Of course, the chestnut in general, your book, The American Chestnut, it's called The Perfect Tree, and it is in so many ways. And people here don't realize it was very predominant in southern Indiana and, of course, across Kentucky and in the mountains. Tell us why it was the perfect tree and how important it was to, business and farming both.
Well, I call it the perfect tree because it was kind of perfectly suited to human needs and to the needs of all the critters and people in its ecosystem. The tree grew tall and straight, making for sort of this very nice timber that was rot-resistant and proved to be just an incredibly versatile kind of lumber. It could be used for, you know, framing houses, for shingling houses, for making furniture. People made pianos out of it. They made packing crates out of it. It was used for utility poles and for railroad ties. But it was also used, you know, again, in fine furniture and in coffins. It just served a wide variety of uses. And then on top of that, the tree very reliably gave forth thousands of nuts every fall, and you know, they were tasty and nutritious, and they were nuts that animals feasted on and people did. Now, in the southern Appalachians, eastern Kentucky, the tree had a particular value because for the mountain farmers there who were basically subsistence farmers, the tree was kind of like this boon. They didn't have to work to get it, and yet it provided sort of ample provisions, both by way of the lumber and by way of the nuts. Mm-hmm. And so people would harvest the nuts every fall and then bring them down to the country stores and sell the nuts, and that would allow them to buy the kinds of things that they weren't able to make for themselves, like, you know, shoes or school books. So over time, it acquired not just an economic importance for the people in the Appalachians, but also this real cultural importance. People kind of considered it an iconic tree of the region.
So, Susan, were other people equally as fond of their chestnuts, the English chestnut or the Italian chestnut, the Chinese chestnut, were there similar, you know, associations and reverence for them?
You know, I don't know a lot about the Asian chestnuts. I know that they were cultivated, you know, for millennia, and I have to assume that they had that same importance. In Europe, the chestnut was hugely important. You go into places like in Tuscany or in Corsica, where people have been growing chestnuts for centuries. And again, it was this tree that just provisioned so much. And, you know, the saying was a family with a chestnut would never go hungry. I remember talking to a guy, I was in Italy about 4 years ago, and talked about how, you know, the chestnut trees that his family grew had kept the family alive during World War II when food was very scarce. So, yeah, it had a huge importance in other countries as well.
Excuse me. Nutritionally, then, high value?
Very high value. It's really more like a nut than anything else. I mean, they're you know, low fat, high in carbohydrates, high in protein. It's a very healthy nut to eat.
Wow.
And then the sheer beauty, these would get 10, 12 feet thick and 100 feet tall. Just the scope of that is just astounding.
They were beautiful trees, and they would have these blossoms, which didn't smell so great, but really looked beautiful.
They don't.
People talked about the mountains kind of looking like there was snow on the mountains when the chestnuts were in full bloom.
Uh-huh. And then about, I think, 1904, a man named Herman Merkel at the Bronx Zoo noticed there was some trouble with his chestnut trees. Talk about that and how the blight got started.
Well, that was the first observed instance of the blight. The blight was a fungus that originated in Asia and probably was brought into this country on Japanese or possibly Chinese trees imported in the late 19th century. Now, in Asia, the blight is harmless to the trees. They've co-evolved for a long time. But when it came to the U.S., American chestnuts had no history of exposure and therefore no defenses. So, you know, this man, Herman Merkel, was the first one to kind of notice something was wrong with the chestnuts at the Bronx Zoo now. And he then alerted a botanist who worked at the New York Botanical Garden across the way, a guy named William Merrill. And William Merrill looked at the trees and decided, yeah, there's something funny here. And he began looking into it and realized it was this fungus that had never been observed in this country before. And pretty much by the time he had figured out what it was, the outbreak was in full force. And the blight, it's often said that the blight started in New York. That's not really the case. It started pretty much wherever you had Asian chestnuts planted. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it gained force with tremendous speed. And in the space of about 50 years, it managed to kill virtually every mature living chestnut in the native range.
How did the fungus spread?
Probably, well, spread a lot of different ways. I mean, it produces spores. So animals, birds, insects would carry it. The wind would carry it. Mm-hmm. And at the height of the pandemic, you just had, you know, trillions and trillions of spores floating around in the air in the forest. And in places like in eastern Kentucky, where chestnuts were as many as one in four trees in the forest, it wasn't very hard for it to move from tree to tree.
So what causes, you know, how does the fungus manifest itself, I guess, and what causes the death of the tree ultimately?
Well, it started with spores. So the spores get into under the bark of the tree, and they form this kind of mat of fungal tissue that basically starts chewing its way through the layer of cells in the tree that carry food and water and nutrients from the roots to the top of the tree. And as it gradually works its way around the stem or around a branch, it sort of chokes off the supply of nutrients. So once it girdles the stem or the branch, then the stem dies. Now, the blight doesn't actually kill the root system of the tree. It just kills the trunk. And often what happens is the tree keeps sending up little suckers for a long time.
Sad, almost.
But because the blight's still hanging out there.
So
once
just kills
the shoots
off,
get to be a certain size, it comes back and kills them off again.
Sort of a sad, pathetic reminder of the past.
Elms do that, too.
Yeah.
Just for the record, will you pronounce the name of the blight? Because I don't want to give it a shot on the air. Cryptonectari tree?
Well, it's gone through various various classifications, but now it's known as Cryphonectria parasitica.
Okay.
All right.
And does it still exist?
Yeah, it does still exist, as do chestnuts. I mean, the tree was never actually extinct because of this resilient root system. So mm-hmm. what happens is you have all these chestnut saplings out there, you know, millions of chestnut saplings.
But just they can't reach.
But the blight still is hanging out in the forest. It'll sort of, it lives on oaks, it lives on sumac. People aren't really sure of all the hosts that it lives on without mm-hmm. causing any damage. But again, as I said, as soon as the saplings get to a certain size, the fungus will come back in full force and kill them off. So it's sort of, the tree's kind of stuck in this biological limbo.
Yeah, and your book touched on the fact that the federal government wasn't nearly equipped to begin to deal with this problem, and states like Pennsylvania tried to cut down every chestnut tree, good or bad, in the whole western part of the state, and both failed.
Yes, that's true. I mean, you have to remember that the blight broke out in the early 20th century. The U.S. Forest Service was just founded, you know, in 1907, I think, mm-hmm. or 1904, and they had never encountered an outbreak on this kind of scale. So their advice was basically to cut down every chestnut. Now, Pennsylvania decided to try something different. They wanted to try to quarantine the blight, and they figured the eastern part of the state's gone too far. We can't do anything about that, but maybe we can stop it from getting into the western part of the state where you really had all the chestnut orchards and major forests. And if we can stop it from getting into western Pennsylvania, then maybe we can prevent it moving on down into the Appalachians. So they did this very heroic effort to try to locate and cut out every diseased chestnut tree in the western half of Pennsylvania, which was an area of like 6.5 million acres. And, you know, it was very noble, but it was pretty futile. And after about 2 years, they realized that this was not going to work, and they called it quits. And by that time, there was no stopping the pandemic.
Well, your book details in a small and hardy band of people over the years tried to various ways to stop this thing or to reintroduce the chestnut, including crossbreeding, actual irradiation of some trees, and fighting back with another virus, and mm-hmm. studying the genetics of the tree, finding one of the 500 trees left that's still good and use the genetics. Talk about some of those efforts that were made.
Well, probably the foremost effort is the American Chestnut Foundation, which was started in 1989 by a retired corn geneticist named Charles Burnham and a nut farmer named Phil Rutter. And they came up with a novel breeding program, a new way of breeding trees that would involve taking an American chestnut and crossing it with a Chinese chestnut and then doing a succession of crosses back mm-hmm. to an American parent in order to gain the trait of blight resistance but then gradually dilute out other of the Asian tree traits so that ideally you would end up with a tree that looked and grew the way the classic American chestnut did but would be resistant to the chestnut blight. And they've been at it, the group has been at it now for almost 25 years, and they have harvested what they hope will be their first generation of blight-resistant nuts that are now in the ground and growing.
Mm-hmm.
They've yet to challenge them to see if they will work, but right. It's a very promising program, and it's, you know, got thousands of members at this point, including in Indiana and in Kentucky, and it's a very hopeful project, and you know the next question for them will be, can they get it out into the forests again? And that's going to be the next challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then toward the end of your book, it's kind of a nice full circle in a way that you went to eastern Kentucky. There's an organization called the Appalachian Region Reforestation Initiative, and you spent some time out there in the old strip mines and where the mountains were cleared off, looking at chestnut trees. Talk about that.
Well, that's an amazing project because what they're doing is they're taking this landscape that really looks as if it's been through a bomb. I mean, it has been through a bomb blast. It's sort of this lunar landscape, but it actually turns out that some trees grow very well on abandoned strip mines, and one of the trees that grows really well is the American chestnut. And mm-hmm. so they've got, right now it's really just sort of a lot of test plantations, but their hope is that chestnuts are such fast-growing trees and such competitive trees that their hope is that once we have some blight-resistant trees in hand, that we'll be able to grow them on these abandoned surface mines and use them as kind of a springboard to get the chestnut back out into the wild. And it's kind of a neat idea because it's both remediating the species and this devastated landscape at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And it'll restore hopefully the flora and the fauna, the wild hogs and the squirrels and everything else that used to feed those chestnuts.
Yeah, because the tree is such a boon to wildlife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Susan, before the blight hit, what was the native range of the chestnut?
Before the blight hit, mm-hmm. from Georgia to Maine, northern Georgia to Maine, and then on east into Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky.
Around here.
Yeah.
So of the billions of trees or millions of trees that have succumbed to the blight, there are some left, right? About how many, and like what's their, how are they dispersed, and how are they proving to be sort of stars in this scenario and breeding a resistant chestnut?
Well, it's kind of an amazing thing. You know, in any epidemic, there are always some individuals that have some kind of resistance. I mean, that's true, you know, whether we're talking smallpox or chestnut blight. And what it appears is there's probably a few hundred mature chestnut trees that seem to actually be able to live with the blight and endure the blight. They're not totally resistant, but they're hanging in there. And there's a scientist named Gary Griffin at Virginia Polytech who has been working, trying to locate these survivors. And, you know, there's probably, he estimates about 500 through the whole range. And he's been trying to locate those trees and breed them in the hopes that through a series of crosses, he can gradually amplify what is a fairly modest, probably a fairly modest resistance in each individual tree, but ultimately come up with a tree that's pretty resistant. And then he wants to combine that with this virus, this sort of naturally occurring virus that kind of cripples the fungus to give the trees another
super duper, you know, American chestnut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's a really long range program, and it's a real long shot program just because the number of trees you're starting with is so small and their resistance is modest. But it's cool to think that you could actually take these, you know, veteran surviving trees and bring back, you know, something that is truly and completely 100% American.
Right.
It's an excellent book. I had just one little disappointment in it. I was reading the poem about under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. It's a horse chestnut. Because the horse didn't work in his meter, so he took horse out.
That's right. Longfellow knew that.
Yeah,
and, then when that tree died, they cut it down and turned it into a chair for him, and he wrote another poem about chestnuts giving that chair. And I also think he didn't mention that it was a horse chestnut in the second poem.
It reads well, though.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a great book, a lot of research, well-written, and a lot of home folks would be interested in that one, I think, too.
Yeah.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot,
thank
Susan.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate your time.
Susan Franco is a freelance science writer based in San Francisco. Her book, The American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree, was printed by the University of California Press. For more information on the book or Susan, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill with a few questions. First one for Miss Wishy.
All right, fire
from
away.
Ann Petty, who has a couple of orchids and has questions about the same. When do you cut the stems back after they bloom?
After they bloom. So probably she's talking about Phalaenopsis and two approaches. I mean, basically when they're finished blooming, you can go ahead and cut those stalks back all the way to the ground. I mean, isn't that what you do?
Right.
But what I have learned that and have tried, it doesn't always work. If you look along that stem, you know how you'll see like those little leaflets and little nodes on that stem?
Yes.
Go back to and prune the stem just above one of those nodes or a little leaflet, and you can sometimes encourage additional buds to set and you'll get more bloom.
Oh.
How about that? So that's the first thing I would try, Anne, and see if it does initiate some sort of new growth from that node. And if it doesn't, then go ahead and cut it all the way down to the, you know, the base of the plant, okay?
Sounds good to me.
All right, and here's one, Bob, from Frank. I have several large azaleas that look like they need a haircut. Lots of spikes of new growth that are spriggy and anywhere from 4 to 8 inches above the rest of the top of the surface. If I cut them now, will I lose blooms next spring?
And the word yes. So it's a debate whether you want to deal with the spikes and enjoy the blooms or cut them back and lose those things but have it look nice going into the winter.
Right, and you won't lose all the blooms because you won't be, you know, removing...
Just the spiky ones.
I mean, wouldn't you remove the spiky ones if they look sort of funny?
I don't know. I wait so long for azalea blooms, I leave them on, but it's just a personal choice. But you can do that and still get some blooms from the other ones, as you say,
Because basically, whatever you don't cut will bloom. So, yeah, it's a personal choice. Yep. And you're not, you know, all in all, you're not going to do any major damage and you'll still get a little bit of bloom. Right. So.
Question from Nettie in Fairdale for Miss Wishy. Mm-hmm. Is this a good time to cut back my rose bushes?
Actually, Nettie, I would wait a little bit longer. I would wait until a couple of like hard freezes before you do any major pruning on your roses. And it depends on what kind of rose it is, too. That's what's kind of tricky about rose questions, don't you think, Bob?
Yes.
But roses that bloom really early in the spring, certain climbers and ramblers, it's best to do pruning right after they finish blooming in the summer. But then hybrid teas and grandifloras, that sort of thing, you would prune. Usually I do it sometime between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
And how high do you go?
All the juices have stopped, you know, moving through the plant. And I usually cut the hybrid tea, those sorts of things, cut them back by about half. Then you can mulch them. And then next spring in March, you pull away the mulch and then you can prune them up a little bit more. But then like the knockout, for example, I don't do anything to that until next spring. And I usually cut it back by about half. So I'd wait a little bit longer because you want them to go into dormancy. And once they're in dormancy, you can do some pruning. Okay.
And I've seen Miss Wishy's roses and she knows of what she speaks.
They do pretty well, don't they?
Yes, they do.
All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have?
Begins with a question for you, Miss Wishy.
All right.
How do you pronounce a climbing vine that's got pretty flowers with the cliche feet in the shade, top in the sun? What plant is that?
Clematis.
You pronounce it clematis?
Uh-huh.
Okay, because that's the word of the week.
Okay.
The sign of the week. It's funny.
He looks at me like, okay, you pronounce it clematis.
No, I know. Well, that's.
I used to say clematis, but now I say clematis.
Well, happily for all concerned.
You can say both.
You can say both, There's, in fact, there's three ways. There's clematis, which the Brits and Janine Wishy say.
Uh-huh.
Clematis, which Americans and Hoosiers say.
Uh-huh.
Then there's clematis, which the Scots say. Usually it's clematis.
Clematis, that makes me nervous.
I know, it sounds a little bit like Eastern Kentucky a little bit. Either way, it's a beautiful climbing vine. There are some shrub varieties, of course. I'm sure you grow the thing. There's spring, summer, and fall bloomers. I love the plant. In fact, my arbor, my rose arbor, is being converted more and more to
a clematis
arbor.
Well,
roses and clematis blooming at the same time.
Uh-huh.
It's a native plant. There's at least 200 species found in North America, South America, Asia, just all over the world. The name comes from the Greek clema, which means twig or climbing tendril.
Huh.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Some of its more colorful names are Traveler's Joy, which makes sense, Leather Flower, which I'm still mulling over, Vase Vine, I've never seen it in a vase, but it might be kind of cool coming in there. Old Man's Beard, perfect because of the seed pods, you know, those bushy seed pods. And the early American settlers called it the pepper vine and used the seeds as a substitute for pepper.
Huh.
And finally, it's also called the firecracker vine because if you burn the seeds of a particular cultivar, they pop.
Cool.
Like exploding sounds. I've never done that.
Huh.
First introduced to England about 1600, and it went back and forth between the colonies and England ever since.
Sure.
Probably the most famous one is Jackmanny, which has been around since 1848. But it comes with a poem of sorts, and I want a little bit of kudos here for trying to rhyme clematis in a poem.
I guess you could say it any one of its three ways.
I'm going with clematis. It rhymes better that way. Only a fool would write a poem on clematis, a vigorous plant often grown on lettuce. So I send you this poem, consider it gratis, in danger of committing poetry malpractice. Please accept this ditty, consider it loco parentis, while asking myself, can there be any real bliss in pushing the limit of verbal nonsensus? Then of necessity resorting to poetic laryngitis, or perhaps badly injuring my poor epiglottis. So I leave this poem now, call it Poet's Arthritis, of clematis I sing, but we've all had enough of this.
Indeed. Nice try. Well, kudos to the attempt.
It's hard to write clematis, rhyme clematis 10, 12 times in the same.
I'm amazed that you got that out in first try.
It's
hard
Bobby
to
Burns.
Say.
Yeah.
All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to find out what Botanica's plans for a new botanical garden are after all.
Homegrown is produced by the naturally talented Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.